Welcome, everyone. Let's go ahead and call the meeting to order. I think we'll go right into, you want Mark to go ahead and call, Mark, if you can go ahead and call the roll.
Okay, be glad to. Mr. Rob Behnke. I see you on there, but you're on mute.
I'm here, sorry. Thank
you. Okay. Dr. Lisa Bellner. Dr. Lisa Bellner.
Present. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Dr. John Benitez. Dr. John Benitez. Dr. John Brophy.
Yo.
Dr. Richard Cole.
I'm here by phone.
All right. Dr. Ceresia Cummings.
Here.
Ms. Lisa Hartman. Ms. Lisa Hartman. Dr. Jeff Hazelwood.
Present.
Mr. Dan Hedrick. Mr. Dan Hedrick. Ms. Jenny Howard.
I'm here.
Okay, terrific. Dr. Greg Kaiser.
I'm here.
Ms. Amy Moses. Ms. Amy Moses. Dr. Wills Oglesby. Dr. Wills Oglesby. Dr. Robert Snyder.
Here.
Ms. V. Story. Ms. V. Story. Dr. Jim Talmadge. Dr. Jim Talmadge. Dr. David Tudor.
Here.
Ms. Misty Williams.
Present.
Okay. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I count 11. That's more than enough for a quorum. So we do have a quorum to be able to proceed, Dr. Tudor.
Excellent. Thank you, Mark.
You're welcome.
With your introduction of non-committee members, or do we have non-committee members that are with us today?
Yes. Mark, have you identified individuals on virtual?
Let me see if I can pull that up. Go to participants.
Jonathan May, I'm here.
Thank you, sir.
Absolutely.
Telephone 313-615-313. Okay. Amanda Terry, Bureau. Troy Haley with the Bureau.
Hey, everybody. I'm here, but I'm in my office. I'm not comfortable with this hybrid format, so I'm more comfortable with the virtual right now. So I'll come in and see everybody after the meeting in the conference room, though. Good to see everybody.
I think that means don't give him a hug.
We also are showing Amelia Mitchell.
Yes, I'm with Schmidt Government
Salute. There's a telephone number 1404.
Alex O'Neill with Arbicare.
There's a telephone number 1901. Let's see. Okay. Ann Zimmerman?
She's with the Bureau.
Carla Townsend?
Good afternoon. I'm with the NCCI, the State's Workers' Compensation Advisory Organization.
David Price?
Good afternoon. This is David Price with Preferred Medical.
Elijah McLaughlin?
I'm with Butler and Snow.
Okay. Jennifer Schneider is with the Bureau. Jonathan May, I believe he introduced himself just a minute ago. Judy Bobbitt.
Hi, everybody. This is Judy Bobbitt with Tennessee Orthopedic Alliance.
Catherine Moffitt.
Hi, yes, Catherine Moffitt with Tennessee Academy of PAs.
Keisha Matcham. I believe she's with the Bureau, right?
Yes.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Kyle Jones is with the Bureau. Lacey Connors with the Bureau. And that's all that I have on mine. If there's anybody that we've missed, please speak up and identify yourself.
Yarnell Beatty, Tennessee Medical Association.
And this is Patrick Robinson with ODG by MCG Health.
Tiffany Grabowski with Healthy Systems.
Laura Roberts with Corvell.
Okay.
Right. Very good. Thanks, Mark. Again, welcome.
You're welcome.
Welcome, everyone. We appreciate everyone being here today. We'll move on and look at the minutes from the March 7th meeting. I hope everyone's had a chance to review those. Any corrections, dissensions, comments?
The only correction that I found was that the meeting was held in the large BWC large conference room and not in the Tennessee room.
No. Anyone else? All right. If not, do we have a motion to accept the minutes with that change?
Motion to accept.
Thank you, Dr. Brophy. Do we have a second?
Second.
All right. Any opposed? All right. Great. So the 3-7-23 minutes have been approved with the change of venue. I know conflict of interest forms is on our agenda, but I think those are up to date for the moment, although new fiscal year begins next month, I guess. So will those be forthcoming with the next meeting?
We'll be starting all over again.
Yay. All right. All right, so.
Mr. James just joined us here. So you can sit up here if you want to. So.
I'm all right here.
Okay.
Well, we just asked Teresa on camera, so she volunteered. all right, very good. Well, we will move ahead into old business. I do believe we have an ODG update for May.
In your packet handout were the ODG updates to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, to topical analgesics, on those two categories. A number of changes that had to do with the whether or not they were required prior approval. If you look at your list on those, besides the names, then there's two, either a yes or a no, and then a Y or an N. So the first yes would indicate that there are there's a generic available, and the second, either the Y or the N, indicates its status as to whether or not it requires prior approval. So N would mean needs prior approval. And most of the changes in this entire list had to do with moving the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory topical compounds to a separate category. And I want to thank Tiffany for bringing to my attention that the posted drug formulary that I had originally posted had some errors to it, and so with her help, those were corrected. And so it was posted the end of about the first week in May to be effective the 1st of May.
So are there just four topicals?
Four that changed.
That changed.
Bob, this is Jeff Hazelwood. Can you re-educate me again on the lidoderm patches being a wide drug now? That still has to be used for neuralgic pain, or does that mean we can use it for myofascial pain?
It's a yes and a yes. Lidocaine and lidoderm are now yes and yes. So there is a topic. I mean, generics available, but it is also does not require prior approval.
But it doesn't have to be just neuralgic pain, because you know we use them a lot of times for neck and back pain, which basically is off-label usage since it's not nerve pain. But I just wondered
There's no restrictions on this one.
Okay. All right.
Yes, thanks, Dr. Hazelwood. That is a change for us. I do still see, though, that there are a lot of combination medications with medications that keep the some of the NSAIDs from upsetting stomachs. And just so you know, a lot of the insurance companies will be calling doctors and say, hey, you know, can we substitute generic this two generic pills instead of one expensive pill? So I do see that some of those are moving to generic, so that will help a bit too.
Any other questions or comments? If not, we'll look for a motion to accept these updates.
So moved.
Thank you, Dr. Kaiser. Do we have a second?
I'll second the motion. This is Misty.
Okay.
Thank you, Misty. All right, any opposed? All right. If not, we will update the accept the ODG updates as written. All right. So we've next on our agenda is the medical fee schedule update.
So the medical fee schedule came back to us this week from the Attorney General's office for some grammatical changes. And it will be sent back to the AG's office again in hopes that that part of the process will be completed sometime very shortly, and then it will go then to be posted. So we're looking for action sometime this summer.
Excellent. Any questions or comments on the fee schedule? If not, we'll move on to a rules and legislation update. Amanda, do you have that for us today?
Yeah, I think we went over, Dr. Snyder, am I right? Did we go over the last time all of the information?
A lot. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So nothing else new there, just the information that we had with the three bills that affected workers' comp. So,
do you want to give an update on the PTSD bill that it did get a public chapter number and what it entails?
Yes, could you give me just 2 seconds?
I think I've got it handy here, okay. Amanda. It was the James Dustin Samples Act. It was signed by Governor Lee and effective on May 17th, 2023, Public Chapter 465. And that is the legislation that would create a presumption that a firefighter diagnosed with PTSD was injured in the line of duty, and it's compensable under the workers' comp law. The main involvement that we will have in that is the grant program that is to be established with the Department of Labor and fire marshals to sort of offset the fiscal impact of that to mainly city and county governments. We had our first meeting last week, and we're well on our way for rulemaking purposes. The legislation went into effect May 17th, but for all other purposes, January the 1st of 2024 is the effective date on that. So that's sort of the update on the status.
So will the in regards to the fiscal impact, will the state cover the entire cost of those programs, or will that still be primarily up to the local cities and counties?
The legislature set aside $445,000, I believe, in the first year, and then $880,000+ in the second and subsequent years for that grant program. The legislation has got a 4-year sunset on it, so we'll sort of see how things go and see how the grant program goes and how the money is used and how many, you know, cities and counties take advantage of the grants.
Would that be retroactive, or is that just new cases going forward that presumption will apply to?
My understanding, it's just new cases going forward, but that ultimately would be up to, if we're talking about a cumulative thing, that's sort of the intent of the legislation. Okay. Because, you know, historically, you've had to have a sudden event, sudden fright, shock, or a mental claim to be compensable under the Workers' Comp Act, and this would expand for firefighters, expand that to a cumulative trauma event. So, you know, there are some ins and outs to the legislation, certain factors that have to be satisfied as far as the injury being work-related. It can't be a situation where, you know, the firefighter got upset because he got disciplined or terminated or anything like that. It's got to be specifically related to certain identifiable work events. But there's a long history to this legislation. It would take me this whole time to cover some of the meetings I've had over several years with firefighters and you know, others that had influence in this legislation. I think the key stat to me is that the legislation was co-sponsored by every single member of the Senate. All 33 members signed on, and in the House, I think it had 80 something out of the 99. Representative sign on. So it was obviously a legislative mandate. It had a fiscal impact, a fiscal note. The legislature went out of their way to find the money to fund it. And it's, you know, it's 5 years or more in the making. They finally got the fiscal impact and the language tightened up to a point where it could proceed. So very interested to see how it plays out, but I think there will be some court determinations about exactly what is compensable and what is not compensable. So I'm going to sign off and not say any more about that.
Thank you. Thank you. Very good. Any other comments on legislative matters? If not, we'll move on to UR report and UR organization annual report.
Okay, the utilization review report in your packet were UR stats for quarter four, and we compared them. Then we got the quarter one statistics for 2023, so you can see that there was 21 and 22. We didn't go back and let that lapse. But it's interesting to see from 2018 through the first quarter of 2023, the fall in the number of utilization review appeals for opioid medications. And I think probably mirrors a overall reduction in the use of opioid medications as time went on. The other thing of note under quarter one of 2023 is the, although it's a very, very small sample, that we overturned the denials in 75% of those. The reason probably is that those were legacy claims, long-term claims with low doses of opioids, probably in the neighborhood of 30 to 40 MMEs. And as a result, then, we didn't feel that the denial of those low doses warranted the amount of consternation that would have been created by denying those medications. Almost all of these opioid medications are in combination with either three or four different psychoactive medications, gabapentin or trazodone or Valium or any one of the number of other medications, and it's hard to sort out what would and would not be worthwhile to go through the hassles of trying to wean an individual that has been on these medications long-term off of them.
It looks like the UR stats are down overall. Are the number of claims down overall, too? Troy, do you know, or does anyone know? I mean, it's down like 20%, like major procedures.
It varies quarter to quarter. We've seen an uptick, a significant uptick, in the second quarter of this year, March, April, May, and June already. Our numbers are back up. It just varies quarter to quarter, so I wouldn't stand too much on those particularly. The overall number of injuries reported, first reports of injuries, is still roughly between 90 and 110,000 a year, which is back to pretty much what it was before the pandemic. And the number of utilization review appeals that we get just varies quarter to quarter. It's pretty much returned to normal. As I reported the last time, there has been a significant change in who does appeal. We've seen more appeals from the representatives of the employees, the injured workers, than we have from the physicians.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think as far as the first reports, of course, the COVID numbers are, you know, way, way down, but the other numbers are up. So I think we're basically back to pre-COVID times.
So most of the cases, going back to the opioids, it sounds like we're on multiple medications with benzodiazepines and gabapentin. And does that come into play at all with when you're looking at overturning a denial in regards just to overdose risk, I guess, with the, I guess,
right.
Kind of new to me numbers coming right. Out with gabapentin?
The biggest thing that we see is that we have to be very careful to make sure that individuals on these multiple medications are either have Narcan around the house or that they've been evaluated for sleep problems, sleep apnea, or so. It's not just the opioid, obviously.
Right.
We have limited ability. I mean, we can only review medications that are denied. But we can make suggestions, which we do quite often, suggestions as to how to approach. So if an individual, even if we approve or overturn the denial of the medication, if an individual is on three or four different medications, it could affect that one. And we make the suggestion that each medication be reviewed independently by the physician. So
does it come into play whether they've had a psychiatrist recommend the benzodiazepine or a pain specialist recommend the combination?
It does. It does. So a lot of the medications that are approved by a psychiatrist are very quickly overturned to denials. So
This is Hazelwood. I'm really running into problems with sleep apnea and situations. I had a patient today that deserves their opioid. They're on 20 milligrams morphine equivalent a day, had four or five surgeries, but maybe has sleep apnea, but does not have private insurance to afford a sleep study. So what, and I've talked to Bob about this and Jim, but what is one to do in that situation where CDC revision guidelines basically say you should not write opioids if you're high risk, in other words, not on CPAP. So I don't see that it's the insurance company's responsibility to pay for a sleep study, but it doesn't seem fair to the patient to stop the opioids because they cannot afford a sleep study. So that's a, you know, it's amazing how many people in Tennessee have sleep apnea, and it's also amazing how many people in Tennessee are not on CPAP. So it's a conundrum that I'm running against quite often, much more than I used to. So I don't know what the answer is when they can't afford a sleep study. And I hate to just pull their narcotics. But really, per CDC guidelines, that's what should be done if they're not on not using CPAP. So any thoughts there from anybody? Misty, do you want to pay for the sleep study?
Now, you know the answer to that. but you know, as a nurse on that side of me, definitely, you know, understands and sees, and we want people to have what they need. On the good side, though, I do see naloxone regularly prescribed for people that are on fairly high doses of opiates. I don't know about other insurers, but on our end, they're certainly not having any problem getting those filled.
Yes, that's very important.
We received approximately, we have not been able to analyze the data yet, we received approximately 40% of the URO reports at this point, and until we analyze the data, there's no reason to go further into that. The other thing was that we saw two cases during the course of this quarter where a utilization review had denied a diagnostic procedure within 30 days of the incident of the injury. And so those were very quickly notified and overturned that those denials are not appropriate and not according to the statute. So
they denied diagnostics?
They denied diagnostics within 30 days of the injury.
Like what kind of diagnostics?
One was an ultrasound and one was an MRI.
Oh. Very invasive, dangerous procedures.
Yes.
Yeah. Not even expensive procedures anymore. Okay. All right. Anything else there with you all? That's good. Good discussion. Thank you. So, COVID update.
There have been an additional 124 claims reported in the first quarter in the first 4 months of 2020, or first reports of injury for COVID within in 2023. So the total numbers still remain below 15,000 for all of that. I checked with the courts today. There was one case that was dismissed on summary judgment because that the individual who had made the application to the courts had failed to provide medical evidence that the cause of her continuing symptoms were related to her vaccine from COVID. And she was not able to show that with medical evidence that the two were related, and so that was released. There is one status hearing on a death claim that's to occur at the end of this month, and we have just received word that the first mediation is occurring on a long COVID claim. So, as I said before, I've been surprised at the total number, at the limited number of appeals and requests for treatment or petitions for benefits have been filed with the courts over COVID and over long COVID. So this is the first one that's presently in mediation that we know of, and so it'd be interesting to see how they develop that that mediation.
Hopefully that means that's the right compensability decisions are being made at the beginning of a claim.
I hope so.
Very good. Move ahead to Medicare set aside.
Everybody's favorite subject, right? Well, Dr. Bellner brought this up last time, and so I, with the great help from Paul Signoffi from Maine, was able to find, and I put in your packet, the payment criteria for Medicare set-aside fund, okay? And there are six criteria that Medicare has for Medicare set-asides. And so I bring that to your attention. The important one for physicians is that medical bills and pharmaceuticals must be paid consistent with any state workers' comp fee schedules. So if you have an individual that is accessing a Medicare set-aside for their post-accident or post-workers' comp treatment, then they're to be paid at the fee schedule. The other big restrictions on that is somebody has to maintain a line item detail of expenditures for Medicare set-aside. So that's interesting. Also in your packet, are there any questions about that?
I'm just curious, is anyone seeing patients that are fall into this payer category?
I think Dr. Bellner had one, which is what brought up the issue.
Yes, and Dr. Snyder.
Yes.
So what is our plan if they're not paying by the state fee schedule?
Then you can send the individual patient to collection because this is a closed it's a closed claim. And if they have so you bill the individual, and it's their responsibility then to evaluate that with their administrator.
So not the company that's responsible for the bills, the actual patient?
It's the patient. Medicare set-aside is administered by a company.
Yeah.
Who does that? Is that the insurance?
Well, there's certain companies that handle administration Medicare set-asides. Huh. Ametros
is the one we see most often.
Yes.
Huh, okay.
Just out of curiosity,
a self-administered employee, which we, you know, we don't see on large ones, but how are they supposed to know what the fee schedule is? I assume the clinics don't know that, right?
They don't, and that's the challenge in trying to educate the population on what an MSA is and what it's for. And that's something that, you know, we as insurers try very hard to think about when we're offering settlements that do require an MSA set aside. And we just want to make sure that the best things are getting done for them. And so often they don't have the means to manage that type of complexity. So it's a challenge.
As counsel for injured workers, I always advise them that if we should professionally administer it, I feel like I'm as sophisticated in the space as somebody's likely to be, and I wouldn't want to administer my own. But it's, you know, there are instances where the value is such that the carrier doesn't want to do it and the client is not, you know, not interested, and the court, of course, won't even really look at an MSA specifically. I just didn't know if there's a resource available to them if they're not sure how much you're supposed to pay on the bill, that there's someone we can direct those people to find out what the fee schedule should be.
Susie. I'll throw Susie out of the bus.
Well, we're going to have those guides.
Yeah. The guides will be available to anyone. But at
online,
this point in time, we answer those questions daily. So.
Okay. Thank you.
And the other part of this is that with the packet of information that we sent out, I sent out the link to the 30-minute guide for medical treatment after settlement, which is it walks an individual and providers through what to expect after about medical treatment after settlement. So it is well worth having that information if you have questions from your from employees or from individuals that ask what's going to happen about their medical treatment after settlement.
Is this something that we can direct them to find somewhere on the BWC website so that they can have access to it?
Yes. So the easiest way to find it is under search link. So if you're on the BWC website, then you just put in 30-minute guide, and the first PDF is that document.
Roughly what percentage of claims are settled versus open medicals?
Those with permanent impairments?
Yes.
It's about 70% with open medicals, 75% with open medicals.
Okay.
The court has to make sure that an individual, if they're going to close their medicals, understands what risk they're taking. Mm-hmm. And with the number of pro se litigants, those that don't have attorneys, the court is very careful to make sure that the individual understands what they're doing.
I've had several employees quite concerned that they weren't able to settle their case, that the judge strongly suggested, just short of requiring them to keep open medicals. So I guess that was one of those cases.
Yeah.
All right. Any other discussion there? So the next topic has me quite curious: physician definition. That could go in a lot of different directions, I'm thinking.
Well, the idea of putting this on the agenda was that in Tennessee we have trouble in our workers' compensation population getting mental health services. But it's not unique to workers' compensation. I mean, there's too few mental health professionals. They're all too busy, and why take on the extra burden of workers' compensation problems if you don't need to, okay? And so we have investigated, and there's been no breakthrough as to how we increase mental health services in workers' compensation specifically, okay? Do you extend the treating physician designation to psychologists for mental health services only? Or is there a way to recruit more psychiatrists into the program? And how would you do that? In light of the fact that it's my understanding that approximately 50% of psychiatrists don't bill insurance at all. Most psychologists don't either. So we have a limited pool to deal with. And especially, we don't, you know, if in fact the local governments and obviously those firefighters that are covered under the Tennessee Workers' Compensation Law, if we're going to cover, have a presumption of PTSD, then how are we going to get services for those individuals? And for the local, you know, the firefighters in Shelbyville, or the firefighters, you know, Nashville is obviously is another example. How are they going to enlist mental health services? And then I don't know if you've seen that Blue Cross Blue Shield is in the process of revamping their processes in handling mental health services, because they've been having trouble filling out their networks for behavioral health. So that's as much as I know, but that's the only reason I put that on the definition was to make you aware that we are having trouble with mental health services.
So would the thought be like a mental health panel that could include maybe a PhD psychologist or a master's psychologist?
See, that requires a statutory change.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what we did is we did go through, and I pulled a number of states. Different states have included psychologists in their panels, in their treating physicians, and allow them to do causation and MMI and permanent impairments. New York State's one example. Colorado's another example. Wisconsin is another example where they're able to essentially be the treating physician from the start of a claim to the end of the claim. But if anybody has an answer for how we recruit mental health services, especially in this environment where you can't find them. I mean, if you talk to the hospitals who have these individuals in the emergency rooms, they can't get them either inpatient beds, or they can't get them outpatient services in a reasonable period of time.
Dr. Kaiser's
opinion.
Yes, sir.
Dr. Kaiser and Jonathan both have got their hands raised. Dr. Snyder?
Okay.
I think Jonathan's was ahead of mine. So.
Dr. Kaiser, you may have more to say on this than I do. I was just going to explain from the practice side of this where the problem is. You are going to have more, I suspect, to say about how we solve the problem in terms of medical providers. So I'll defer to you first.
Thank you. You know, I'll say a couple of things. One, I'm aware of, obviously we've talked about this a lot, so I'm aware of this as a problem. And I think some of the issue had kind of come up recently with this concern over expansion and utilizing psychologists and such as that. and you know, several things. One, I've been kind of over the last few months kind of compiling lists of when I do like IMEs or see people in treatment or whatever, I have the opportunity to look at somebody's medical records. If I see somebody that's under workers' comp and they have a psychiatric or psychological provider, I'm kind of making notes of who they are and where they are. And it admittedly, it's a short list, but I've been kind of compiling some of that. It's about 50-50 psychiatrist and psychologist. But I can't really say that that's really representative. It's just been what, you know, it's kind of come across my desk, so to speak. We deal a lot of times in issues of, you know, kind of turf wars, if you will, with the psychologists or other kinds of providers. And, you know, part of the thing is that, there's the same difficulties apply to psychologists and psychiatrists in terms of, access and panels, particularly insurance panels. And I would say probably more psychiatrists take insurance than psychologists do. Just in my private practice, I have a lot of trouble with, you know, finding, you know, therapists, you know, for patients that will take their insurance. So it's kind of, it's not a problem that's only associated with, you know, our side of the road, so to speak. It kind of goes across in general. The Psychiatric Association, we're kind of starting to kind of look into, you know, what can we do about this? And I think I sent a copy of a note that I'd sent to them to Yancey, on, you know, kind of beginning to kind of look into what might happen. I can anticipate what some of the answers are going to be, though. And a lot of it's going to have to do with just the problems that come with workers' comp in terms of just the day-to-day administrative dealings with it. You know, you mentioned earlier in the conversation of kind of throwing Susie under the bus. I throw Susie under the bus every single day. I don't know why she even has not blocked my emails. I send her emails every day, and it's always the same thing. You know, undervaluing, coding, assuming that when I have a written contract with a workers' comp carrier that I'm not a PPO provider, they still send me PPO fee schedule. When we have patients that don't show up for appointments, which is fairly common, you know, we're entitled to bill for that appointment. We get it denied. We get statements that, you know, there's no existing way to pay for missed appointments. Well, that's the Tennessee law. Then they say, well, you didn't use the right code. Well, what code should we use? And they don't really have a good answer for that. So just all these headaches that come with it, it's hard to convince people that it's worth doing. You know, I find it to be rewarding. I enjoy doing it, and I'm happy to tell people about that. And I would be happy to, you know, have a seminar, to, you know, to kind of help people to know, you know, how to get through the system if you're willing to do that. You know, and there's one other thing, and I mentioned this the other meeting too. I didn't really make notes about this. I should have been better prepared. But the other thing is that we have a huge problem with carriers having either case managers or adjusters leave and us not giving notification of that happening. And the way we find out is we send a bill in and something, you know, it gets denied or one of these problems occur. And so we send a message to, you know, whoever the contact person that they've identified for us. And we do that. It's like, well, you know, Mr. X or Mrs. Y is no longer working for the company. And then that's just it. There's been no notification. There's no follow up in terms of, well, why don't you try to, you know, contact Mr. Z instead? So, you know, just today, you know, we have our own contract that we send, and I'm willing to share that with anyone. And all it says is basically we outline what the laws that I've learned from dealing with this from the state of Tennessee, and that we expect that you, the workers' comp carrier, to follow those laws. And what I just added today was a statement that we need to have a contact person. And we need to be notified in writing when that contact person changes. If they're fired or they leave or, you know, they have illness or whatever, As a physician, I can't just abandon a patient and just say, well, I'm just not doing this anymore. I have to give rightful notice about that. And that's the law. And I think that should be the law in workers' comp, too, that we have to be it's like all this stuff that comes with these OGD denials that where it's these kind of nitpicky little things. It's all games that are done to deny payment is what it all comes down to. And it's hard to convince people that that's worth doing.
So I agree 100%.
I think that's all I have to say about it. But
yeah, I want to throw in, too, the same situation with not knowing the insurance adjuster when we call 10 times trying to get approval on something, never get a call back, and then finally somehow we find out we're not even calling the right adjuster because they've changed names. So, I mean, it just burns overhead like crazy. Time spent, delay in treatment, delay in care. It's ridiculous. So I don't understand why there shouldn't be some kind of rule that they have to alert us if the insurance adjuster changes.
Well, and also, Jeff, too, is we try not to do anything on the telephone now. I want to do it in email where I have a track that I sent you an email and either get kicked back to me that it doesn't work or whatever. And it saves a lot of time too, because you know, as Jeff and you and I've talked about this, and I think I've shared some documents with you you know, I just have sadly about 10 standard letters that I can just, you know, type a person's name into and forward it to, you know, whoever it needs to go, and hopefully it goes where it needs to go. And of course, Susie gets a copy of it, and she's great. I mean, she follows up on things, and she, you know, and 9 times out of 10, if they just see that I've sent a copy of it to Susie, that's about all I need to do is that, you know, I'll have, you know, a response quickly.
I've sent an email, but I hadn't copied Susie, so maybe that's the key.
And I'm not sure how much of that she can handle. I'm probably wearing her out, honestly.
Well, the issue with notifications actually is on part of the rule changes that we have coming forward, that it's required that within 14 days of the change of a of an adjuster or status of a claim that the providers be notified. So that we've got that. That's in the works.
Well, that will help tremendously if they will follow through on that.
We'll have the authority to penalize.
Good.
I was going to say they're already required to give notice to the injured worker when that happens, and it doesn't happen. So we can pass rules all day long, but unless we're going to enforce them, it's still going to be a problem.
And we get even, like, again, on my contract, says this contract is valid until we have written notice that it's not. And we get denials all the time. This claim was settled. We're not paying anything. And it might have been 3 months before. And, you know, we can enforce that because we have a contract on it. But it's just, to me, it's administrative malpractice to do that. And I think they should be held accountable to that. One other thing I was going to say was we need to establish also, you know, we use the code 99199 for failed appointment. And sometimes we get kickbacks that's not a valid code, but that's what we looked up. And that's what we found. We're happy to use any code that the industry wants us to use.
The new fee schedule is going to have specific codes for a missed appointment. It'll be state specific. It's called a Z code. Colorado uses them, and we're going to be using them for state specific activities.
Great.
That's in the fee schedule changes.
Yeah, that should help.
Yeah, we've got that one covered.
Is that for any follow-up or only if the case manager insurance company schedules an appointment? I thought that's the way it's written now. A new patient.
If it's not canceled within 1 business day by the company, the case manager, or the adjuster.
Okay, that's tremendous if that comes through.
Is there something in that that allows for the times when the plaintiff just doesn't show up? I mean, the insurance company shouldn't have to pay for that, I wouldn't think. Is there some kind of reasonable account for that?
Well, that's already in statute that the insurance company, we just had a request. So the carrier can suspend benefits if the individual does not refuses or does not abide by the treatment recommendations of the providers.
And that shouldn't be on the physician.
No, it shouldn't.
We've budgeted our time. We're here waiting on the patient. You know,
I really don't think it should. I struggle with the idea of denying benefits because they miss an appointment. There may be a good reason for it. Who knows? Car broke down, whatever. But I don't know what the answer to that is. But it seems a little unfair either way. I think about that, so I don't know what the answer to that. But it seems something seems off with that.
I've never seen benefits denied for missing one appointment, but I can say that I've seen.
It would be a pattern. I mean, exactly. The court would have a difficult time with one individual missing one appointment. But if it's a pattern of missed appointments or failing to show up for 5 physical therapy visits,
that's what I'm saying.
The benefits can be suspended.
Well, I think the world of psychology and chronic pain is where you see so much abuse of it. It's awful. I mean, we have 4, 5, 6 no-shows a day, and they just forgot the appointment, it's just not good reason. And then we have to e-scribe the medicine, and we can't get reimbursed on that. So it just kills you.
Can I circle back to this psychologist-psychiatrist thing?
Yes, please.
So the problem, and I kind of brought this to Troy recently, where on the practice side representing injured workers, what I'm seeing here is that, you know, when we get a panel of mental health providers, we'll get a panel that features 3 PhDs and no medical doctor. And so our client then under 204, that's authorized treatment, the psychological treatment, you know, it, the way that statute is written, that doesn't have to be performed by a medical doctor. And there's, you know, plenty of good reasons for that. If they don't need medication management, we have some really incredible PhD providers that are helping injured workers. Where we run into a problem is all of a sudden we get to the end of the care and everything's been approved, everything's been provided. And all of a sudden when that provider gives an impairment rating, that's when the carrier decides, well, that's not an appropriate rating. And the thing is they are technically correct. And so I understand the Tennessee Psychiatric Association or the TMA would really like to keep this space contained to medical doctors. And if there were enough of their members who were willing to step up and see these patients that we can do that, that would be fantastic. But if they cannot help us get a stable of medical doctors who will take these patients, we are going to have to find another solution to this problem because, I mean, thank God Dr. Kaiser is doing telehealth because with Dr. Golden retiring over here in West Tennessee, if he weren't seeing patients across the state, I don't know where a lot of my folks would be getting treatment right now. But this is a hole in our system that there has got to be either a legislative or rulemaking solution to. And like, this is the body that is best suited to figure that out.
We definitely have problems getting enough psychiatrists and psychologists for the panel. So, Dr. Kaiser, if you can come up with a nice list, I would love to have that. That would help me tremendously because nothing would make me happier than to get some valid panels out to these people quick. Because it's a challenge on our side. Mm-hmm. We call doctor after doctor after doctor. And every day it changes. No, I'm not taking work comp anymore. Well, I'll take work comp, but I mean, you know, so it's a break in the system for everyone.
Right. And pain management as well. It's just horrible.
I was looking to see that's not going to work. Am I up?
Yes, sir.
I'll say a couple of things. One, I'm happy to send me an email. I'll copy it to you, or I can send it to Dr. Snyder. He can send it to everyone. It's not very long. It's about six and six.
Send it to me too.
Okay. I'll do that. I'll just send it to you and then I'll let you distribute it then. The other thing is the Tennessee Psychiatric Association will oppose any expansion of practice of psychologists. I'll just say that straight up.
I understand that position.
There's a long history of that. But in particular, the issue of doing impairment ratings, we came to an agreement with them years ago when I was still the legislative representative over another issue of expansion of practice, and we allowed that. And the agreement was that they would not seek to do what you're asking them to do now. And then they stabbed us in the back and lobbied to do it right afterwards. There's bad blood there on that issue, and we're going to oppose that. We'll do what we can to try and, you know, move something forward. I don't have any problem, and I don't think any of the psychiatrists do have a problem with psychologists being included in the panels. It's not always appropriate that, you know, someone who's had a mental injury needs to see a psychiatrist. They may need, you know, half a dozen sessions of counseling. We may not need to be involved in that. And under those circumstances, you know, I do that all the time. People, you know, send me referrals to do impairment ratings on them, and I'm happy to do that. And I think most of the other doctors that do impairment ratings, psychiatrists, you know, are open and willing to do that. Maybe we can identify some more people that would be. My anticipation is, without beating a dead horse, that a lot of the hesitancy has to do with all these kind of bureaucratic, administrative denial, just problems that seem to be associated with workers' comp that a lot of people have just gotten away from completely with insurance. You know, you mentioned with Blue Cross. You know, the reason that Blue Cross is having a problem, I would imagine, is because they set their fee schedule and kept it that way for 20 years. Blue Cross pays me pretty decently now, but they've only done that like in the last year or two. And it's just been because of a sense of desperation, I believe. I'm done. Can you guys see me?
No.
Yeah, I got a thing up at the top that said the camera wouldn't work, and then I went to my settings, and it says it's allowed for this. So, sorry.
I'll forgive you. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Kaiser. We do appreciate your input and, of course, everything you do for your injured workers.
Well, I appreciate you saying so. And again, I can't speak highly enough about how valuable Susie is to my practice. I mean, it's just – it's like I should pay her.
Talk to Troy about that.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone. That really, really, really good discussion. And I suspect with contracts, we've kind of already flowed over into that topic.
The only one to note is that the issue with contracts that was brought to us in the early part of this year was also investigated by Commerce and Insurance. And there's been some resolution of that, but I just have to say that, you know, you need to look at every single one of your contracts, make sure that there's no sale or lease language in it, and also the consolidations and mergers that you have control over a contract anytime that there's a consolidation or merger. So just for those that have anything to do with contracting, you just can't be too careful.
And I would say good luck finding a contract that doesn't have
a
sale or lease or make you subject to. And they follow from private health insurance to the comp carriers and vice versa. Okay. Well, thanks. So mental health treatment on for new business, and I think we've covered that.
We have covered that. Yes.
I've had too much Starbucks today. But were we saying that we have PhD psychologists on workers' comp panels now?
Panels, yes, to treat.
Oh yeah.
To treat. Okay.
To treat.
Okay.
They cannot do causation analysis. They cannot issue permanent restrictions. They cannot do MMI, and they cannot do permanent impairments.
Okay. I think that's a wonderful business opportunity for Dr. Kaiser. I think he should expand his practice statewide, hire a whole slew of these folks, and then he just oversees them. Are you busy for dinner, Dr. Kaiser?
I don't want to oversee anyone.
Well, I guess there goes that idea.
I don't want to work for anyone. I've been through that. I don't want to work with anyone.
All right. Well, very good.
If there's any other new business.
Yeah. Any other new business that needs to be brought before the committee? Okay. So announcements. I guess the Bureau's conference is next week.
Yes. June 14th, starting at around noon. There's employer reward program starting at 9:30 on Wednesday morning. It's all day Thursday and half day Friday. Go to the website and sign up.
How many attendees? Any idea how many have signed up so far?
475 as of last week.
Okay.
And it's at the Embassy Suites in Murfreesboro.
Very good. All right. Well, if no other new business or announcements other than our next meeting will be September 5th or the Tuesday after Labor Day.
Correct. And just put on your calendars a tentative meeting. The following meeting would be December the 5th.
Is there any update on the physician certification program with the governor signing it yet? Or?
The rules for that program have gone back to the Attorney General's office. We're very close on that one as well. Once that is finalized by the Attorney General, then once the it is published by the Secretary of State, then we're going to start our advertising blitz on that program.
Yeah, we should be good on that. The last change, requested change, had to do with the inactive status. That we worked on that and sent it back over to the AG's office. I think that was yesterday. Today's Tuesday. So, yeah, that was Monday. So, as soon as General Scarmetti puts his John Henry on there and gets it back to me, we'll get it filed. And effective date's 90 days from that date.
Very good.
I had one other thing, if I could.
Yes, sir.
I promised I'd quit talking about this, but I'm not going to. Another thought that occurred to me that I forgot to mention was that I've seen many times in cases of work injury that patients have gone to local community mental health centers. So I think that's a viable alternative, and it would be, I think, very helpful if the Bureau or the state could reach out to the various local community mental health centers and advocate for being able to refer injured workers. They have psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, psychologists, social workers, et cetera. And somehow or another, I know they're already able to see workers' comp patients, but I don't think routinely that happens. And there's, as my understanding, every county has at least one community mental health center. And you know, it seemed like the state ought to be, you know, I think the state helps to a large degree with funding of these. Maybe the state can kind of lean on them to do more of that.
Good idea.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. If nothing else, we'll adjourn.
Thank you, everybody, for your attendance. We hope it was worthwhile.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
I sent you that list, Bob.
In September.
Thank you.